Welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, I want to start today with your recent column for National Review, which is entitled The Eeyore Syndrome. And this is an analysis of the relative merits of pessimistic, optimistic, and realist approaches to trying to predict what the future looks like in terms of COVID-19 and its effects on the country. Why don't I just have you start by delineating those three categories for us?
Maybe it would be better to have two categories, the pessimistic and the optimistic, because the realist is a subset of the optimist, I think, at least in this case. Well, the pessimist really wins because he makes two sorts of predictions, as we've seen with the Imperial College in London, the University of Washington people, or Gavin Newsom or Governor DeWine of Idaho's modeling. And that is, things are really bad, and we're going to have 2.2 million dead, or 200,000 dead, or 25 million people in California infected. And when that proves to be false, the pessimist says, well, I only gave you that worst case scenario in hopes that, and this has already happened, by the way, in testimony in London, I only gave you that pessimistic prognosis so that you would take the necessary measures. And then if it unfortunately turns out to be true, then the pessimist says, oh, I warned you people, it was really bad, I was so worried. Unfortunately, the optimist or the realist says, you know, that can't be true, or I doubt that. If he is correct and we have 30,000 dead or 40,000, 60,000 million cases, anything analogous to the 57 or the 2017 flu or the 2009 flu, then the optimist doesn't get credit because the pessimist says, well, you were only correct because I gave a bleak outlook and that forced people into shelter in place or social distancing, and your data was false, but only because of me were you shown to be right in the aftermath. And if the optimist is unfortunately correct, then he gets no credit. If he's not correct and we do get 2 million people dead, then people say, well, you're a veritable murderer because had you just given us some warning and been more realistic, we wouldn't have had all these deaths. So I think that explains in part why people are so eager or prone to be far more pessimistic than optimistic, because on the back end of it, you have far less exposure. And this debate, whether we like it or not, is shaping up in the parameters of the global warming debate, where it's highly weaponized and politicized. And there's a consensus of opinion that even if your models are too bleak or too pessimistic, they're still valuable and that they should be embraced because they lead to necessary social policy. And if you're too optimistic, even if you're correct, you're still an outlier, or you're still antisocial, or your prognoses don't do anything other than make laxity and naivete and get people killed.
We've talked a lot through this period about the role that class and socioeconomic roles have played in the shutdown. So, for instance, the conversation we've had before, the finance guy, or for that matter, the podcaster who is now sitting at home, they don't seem like the most vital members of society right now. Whereas the trucker and the guy who's stocking grocery shelves and the farmer, they're the ones that are keeping society moving. You pointed out in this piece another aspect of this, which is that your station in the economy may also make a big difference in how you think about the trade-offs between keeping the economy closed down to combat the pandemic and going back to work. Walk us through that.
Well, if I'm a fellow at the Hoover Institution, which I am, which we're all being paid, even though we're not physically on space being employed, then to me, the economic ramifications have not yet at least been as dire as if I were still farming as I am now on my farm, and my income depended on my ability to get out there and buy product, get people to come out and work if I was self-employed. And that also has had a difference. It results in a different aspect of the crisis. The self-employed, the people who are more fragile economically, the people who are more worried about the viability of their small business or even their family, want to get back to work, and they're willing to take their chances because for them, the existential is always closer. It's real. But the people who tend to be on the coast, many of them are tied into the global economy. Many of their incomes are not predicated on either being self-employed or necessarily at work. They telecommunicate more often, and they're much more health conscious. Their life is so good, you don't want to lose a minute of it. And in their way of thinking, I can wait this out, but I do not want to take the chance that I have half of 1% of being infected if they're under 65. So that's one of the divides, and there's many, you know, coastal, interior, politically conservative, politically liberal, that all predicate our views on whether we should get back as quickly as possible and avoid a depression, or we should stay, in the words of Ezekiel Emanuel, Rahm Emanuel's brother, we should stay for 18 months perhaps. Because if we stay for 18 months, he thinks he has zero chance of getting the virus, because it'll either play out or he'll get a vaccination, and he's in an economic position where he won't be that bad off.
Victor, there has been a trend in American life, especially pronounced in the past couple of decades, to elevate science above all other disciplines, to imagine that most issues in life are soluble through reference to science. Now, of course, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Science, especially epidemiology, obviously has a huge role to play. But there are a couple of big qualifiers on that. One, that in terms of the trade-offs present here, especially as regards economics, there are certain prudential calculations here that science can't necessarily guide you through, right? There are other factors to consider beyond the epidemiology. And two, at this still relatively early hour, there are actually pretty big limitations on what the science can tell us, just because there's a lot of information that we don't yet have. So if you're a policymaker, these are two enormous factors in your decision-making process. The fact that you're having to weigh these competing considerations across disciplines, and the fact that you're doing so with incomplete information. So this is essentially, this is the fog of war. And as a military historian, I'd love to have you tell us how one tries to grapple with that, knowing that you can't eradicate it.
Yeah, I think what you have to do is approach the question with some humility, and that science will ultimately save us from the virus, but it won't be science entirely. There'll be common sense, there'll be economic, social, and cultural considerations as well. So here we are, science has told us the viral sequencing of the COVID-19 illness, and it probably will tell us eventually how we can get a vaccination that will save us, or even an anecdote or an antibody or some type of pharmaceutical intervention that can stop the onset of the disease. But we don't have accurate data. We don't have the denominator of the actual number of cases, and we don't really have an accurate numerator, because we don't really know to what degree the reported dead died with or from the virus. But science being science in the 21st century, they have sort of an arrogance about them. And they say, well, we're the scientific people, and we always can find an answer. Well, you can't find an answer because you don't have the data. And the result is we have these very scientific models that are completely flawed about the number of likely deaths, the number of likely infections, and they've been almost all of them have been proven inaccurate. We've had people say you can't, from the World Health Organization, so-called scientists, it's not transmissible between people. It was. Travel bans don't work. They do. Masks are unnecessary. They are necessary. We've had people who say, as Donald Trump did, that hydroxychloroquine has some utility in many cases. Many of the scientists said, no, it doesn't. So they don't have a good record yet, because they're not humble enough to say that we don't have data at our disposal, scientific data that will allow us to pursue the scientific method. Instead, they said the scientific method answers everything, and I'm a scientist and I have a PhD or an MD. And I don't want to hear that I don't have enough data. There's always enough data. Well, there isn't enough data. This is the first major disease in memory that we have tried to establish the case load, how many people are infected, how many people have died from it, what's the death per case percentage, and we just have no information at all. When we when we calculate the flu, we model the number of people we think have the flu. We don't go by the number of people who've actually tested, because we know that's a false number. It's a very small number. But here, because we have no prior models, suddenly the denominator is the people who've tested positive, even though the scientists themselves realize that's a flawed methodology to find out any data that would be useful.
You haven't written about this, but I wonder what you make of the situation we've had in the last few days regarding the USS Theodore Roosevelt. This is the aircraft carrier that was in the Pacific. There was a COVID-19 outbreak, and the captain, Brett Crozier, sent a group memo to people both inside and outside of his chain of command, trying to push approval to get most of the sailors off that vessel to prevent the spread. That memo then leaks to the press, which culminates in the captain being removed. And then Thomas Modley, who is the acting secretary of the Navy, makes remarks to the sailors on the ship where he describes Crozier as being naive or stupid if he didn't think his memo would leak. He's had to resign now as a result of that. So, Victor, there are people who are vehemently defending the captain, saying you want a guy to stick his neck out like that when his men are on the line. And there are people who are vehemently criticizing him, saying you can't lose sight of your bigger imperatives in a moment like that. And letting the world know that an American aircraft carrier is in that kind of potential distress is too big a risk to take, no matter the circumstances. How should we think about this?
Well, both of them were reprimanded and let go, and that was a correct decision in both cases. But the captain actually had greater culpability, because his was a more important policy decision. What he was saying essentially was, my ship will suffer some casualties or damage, and therefore I can't perform my mission, and therefore I won't do my mission, and therefore I want you to know about it, and therefore to show my fides or my humanitarian concerns, I'm going to let other people outside the strict confidential chain of command know that. And by doing that, he more or less allowed people access to the knowledge that the Roosevelt might not be as battle-worthy in the next 2 or 3 weeks as it otherwise would. And in the theoretical context, that can encourage a preemptive attack on it, and he would ironically endanger more people than the virus. So that you can't have a Navy where captains do that. The second thing was that it sounds wonderful that he's so concerned about the crew, but the way that the military works is the crew is secondary to the mission, at least if the mission is viable and logical. By that, I mean, when you go into Schweinfurt and you've got to take out the ball bearing factory, the 8th Air Force commanders do not say, this is a crazy mission, and I just can't perform it. I don't want these people to get killed. If they do that, they're relieved. And then later you can say the mission was ill-founded, which it was. But in the middle of things, you just don't do that. And then finally, the captain didn't have to take his crew into port to an area in Southeast Asia where there was a known contagion on the spread. And he should have had some kind of humility. He could have said, you know, I'm in an analogous situation to a cruise ship that just docked in Miami, to a cruise ship that was in off the coast of Japan. And the funny thing about the data from those cruise ships is they should be petri dishes of incubation. But in fact, they show a very low rate of transmission and a very small rate of death. And yet the majority demography in those ships are older people. In contrast, I have a ship with roughly the same numbers or even more numbers. It's got the same close quarters, but these are robust young people. So I think I can ride this out in a way that these two cruise ships did ride it out, but I think I can ride it out even better. The assistant secretary didn't have to call a subordinate, you know, stupid act. All he had to do was say, there's a variety of protocols that this commander violated and he will be reassigned, and leave it at that. But when he went out and pontificated and editorialized, then he found himself into a lose-lose situation, because he was essentially arguing that the human lives of the crew members were less important than the sanctity of the mission or the reputation of the Navy for deterrence, et cetera. And we all know that's true, but we're not supposed to say it. And he kind of got himself into the position that George Patton did when he said, it doesn't really matter if you die for your country. All that matters is if you kill for your country. I don't want you to be captured or to be killed. I want you to kill the enemy. And of course, that's absolutely right. But when you're the mother or the grieving father of a wounded soldier or one that's killed, you surely don't want to hear that.
Final question for you, prompted by the phrase that you used there earlier in that last answer. So let me read you the lead of a story that appeared in the Los Angeles Times. It's just within the past day or so. This is the quote. The coronavirus pandemic, in an unexpected but potentially fateful twist, has moved the United States and China a big step closer to a new Cold War. It has strengthened hardliners in both countries, and political pressures stemming from the pandemic are making it harder for leaders to back away from escalation. Close quote. Now, if you're a veteran observer of print media, the tell there is the word hardliners. That has an aroma of disapproval around it. But I was going to ask you what you make of this formulation. You've already said we are in a Cold War with China. But there were also people who said, you know, we were in a Cold War with China before this. So I wonder, taking this in its totality, how do you think things materially change when we come out on the other side of this, and how should they change?
The first observation is it's kind of now characteristic or emblematic of the progressive media to always have symmetry between a communist government that's the inheritor of 70 million dead under Mao versus a constitutional republic like the United States. And by that, when they say hardliners, our hardliners are not putting in 1 million people in internment camps. They're not destroying democracy in Hong Kong. They're not lying about a virus. Their hardliners are. Our hardliners are not cheating and dumping and stealing patents and copyrights, infringing on technology rights, et cetera. Their hardliners are. So there's a qualitative moral difference that's not symmetrical, as they suggest. Our struggle with China before the outbreak was not preemptory, it was retaliatory. We weren't the ones that were running up these huge surpluses. We weren't the ones that were stealing their copyrights. We weren't the ones that were dumping product below. We weren't sending defective drywall or polluted dog food to Chinese. And we weren't trying to take resources from them and build them here and then cut the price so low as to destroy their indigenous industries and make them dependent on. That's what China was doing. So that's important to see, and it also dovetails into your larger question, and that is, what's the status of China vis-a-vis the United States, indeed the Western world, or even the global world before and after? China was losing this trade war, and by that, while there weren't a lot of people that were cheering the idea of tariffs on or protectionism or nationalism in Europe and Japan, because they were also guilty of many of the practices that China had embraced, there were people that felt that China was a threat to them, and they were glad to see China questioned by the largest military and economic power in the world, the United States. So they were sort of on our side, even though they didn't want to explicitly say so. And then once we were in a better position, I'm getting at, than China, and when this is all over, people are going to ask themselves, was the United States transparent about its cases? Yes. Was China? No. Did the United States create this virus, or was it created on American shores? No. Did the United States lie about the spread? No. Did the United States lie about the toxicity of the virus? No. Did the United States try to react in a transparent fashion and report statistics that were accurate to the world and, more importantly, to its own people? Yes. To China? No. So its brand has been damaged. And the question that a lot of people are going to have to make in the aftermath is, on the one hand, how valuable is a commercial relationship with China, or low-cost manufacturing with China, or China loans, or China's Silk Road policy, versus how dangerous is that? There's been two coronaviruses now that have come out of Wuhan. We know there will be a third and a fourth. And how many times can an Italy or Spain suffer the type of damage, or us for that matter, that a relationship with China entails? So I think what's going to happen is there's going to be a lot of existential questions that we can't even imagine. Do we really want 15 to 20,000 people coming from China every day without passport control? And we have no idea of their health conditions. Do we really need 360,000 Chinese students? 1% of them might be, you know, over 3,600 of them. and got involved in technological espionage. Do we really want American professors working in joint projects and in concert with Chinese researchers, as a Harvard biochemist who was recently arrested was? These are all going to be questions that I think that are going to be raised, and I don't think that the defenders of the status quo are going to have answers. Does Los Angeles really need 3,000 visitors to fly in daily, as they were bragging before the outbreak? I don't think so. I think that will be framed in different auspices now. It'll be, are we really safe when 7 to 10,000 people fly into California every day from places in China where we know they're not capable of being honest about a viral outbreak? And we haven't even touched upon the idea that there's a conspiracy theory and then there's a Chinese theory about the origins. The origins from the Chinese point of view, when they're not lying that it was a U.S. military project, but their own researchers say it came from a wet market in China. And so the best case scenario wasn't an accident, but they were warned that the cross-fertilization of such species under those conditions could cause a viral outbreak. And yet they not only did not stop it after the SARS outbreak, they kept it and they haven't stopped it now. And that's bad. And the worst scenario, and it's starting to regain credence again, is it's just too much of a coincidence that a stage 4 virology lab run by the Chinese military was just within miles of the outbreak of the virus. And people have suggested, well, maybe they use the meat market, wet market rationale as a smokescreen for the real problem, that this may have escaped, whether by intent, I don't think, but accidentally out of a poorly run but very dangerous westernized like virology lab. And if that's true, that will absolutely destroy China's reputation, because it will be considered like a child with an automobile, that it's westernized, it has the veneer of westernization, it has the appurtenances of the West, but it really can't be trusted because it doesn't have the institutional protections to allow it to use all of this technology that it's imported and taken and embraced as its own.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's also on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.